The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Openness also does not encompass all of America's interests. That is to say, it's a necessary precondition for us to achieve our goals in the world, to allow us to stay interdependent, and to allow us to achieve cooperation in the world, but it doesn't fulfill all of our global aims. And finally, openness doesn't exist without limits. That is to say that in an open world, states will still be able to regulate their borders and to accept some forms of closure, such as regulating their technology industries where their dearest interests demand. So openness is not, like any strategy, a full panacea, but it does express what we believe to be our dearest interests in the world and give us a way forward on how we'll achieve them.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 25th, 2020. Rebecca Listener is an assistant professor at the U.S. Naval War College. Mira Rapp Hooper is a senior fellow at Yale Law School's China Center. Together, they are the authors of An Open World, How America Can Win the Contest for 21st Century Order. It's an ambitious book that looks beyond the liberal world order, arguing that China's rise and America's weakness render the old order obsolete. What will replace it? Listener and Rapp Hooper argue that the United States should push for an open order. They joined me in the virtual jungle studio to discuss why the liberal world order is failing, what role Donald Trump plays in that, whether it is rehabilitatable, and what it means to have the open order that they are describing. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 25th. Mira Rapp Hooper and Rebecca Listener on An Open World. Okay, Mira, I want to start with the ambitious quality of this book. This is an age in which people often take on small subjects, you know, and try to add a small piece to a larger mosaic. You two have taken on a really big subject. And so I want you to start by just describing the question that you're trying to address in this book.
Absolutely, Ben. And let me start really by saying a thank you to you. It's great to be joining you for this conversation. You've been a wonderful supporter of our work, and it's a treat to be able to talk to a Lawfare audience. The real question that motivates our work is the question of what comes next in U.S. foreign policy and in the United States' role in the world. An Open World, our book, is really a call to action. As the coronavirus pandemic has so clearly revealed, the international order that we all long knew is essentially on the brink of collapse. We see international institutions that are clearly fraying. Cooperation between states is elusive, even though there are existential reasons we should be able to cooperate. And great powers are at loggerheads with seemingly no bottom to that spiral. But the damage that we're seeing playing out today began long before this pandemic, and the forces responsible for it will be with us even if President Trump leaves office in January. For the United States to recover from the present crisis, Washington is ultimately going to need a new global strategy, one that rejects both the nationalism that we've seen all too often in recent years and a nostalgia to recoup our former place in the world and looks instead for a forward-looking strategy that ultimately defends an open world.
All right, Rebecca, to what extent is this a post-Trump book? And to what extent is Trump just a kind of blip in the road of the larger forces you guys are thinking about? Would you have written this book if Donald Trump had never existed and the White House had been occupied by either generic Democrat or generic Republican?
So let me begin by just echoing Mira's thanks. It is so wonderful to be here with you today to talk about our book and to speak with you and the Lawfare audience. So as Mira said, our book really makes the case that the United States has to reimagine its foreign policy for a potentially post-Trump and post-pandemic world before it is too late. And we actually started this book in the immediate wake of the 2016 election, when it was already amply clear to both of us that Donald Trump himself was more an avatar than an architect of the massive domestic and international forces that were reshaping American foreign policy. So even if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016, she still would have had to contend with many of the major trends that our book highlights, things like adverse global power shifts, rapid technological change, and acute domestic political dysfunction. So in writing this book, we set out to push back against two pieces of conventional wisdom. The first was the notion that Donald Trump himself was somehow solely responsible for the collapse of American influence and the structures that are often referred to as the liberal international order. And second, the hope that American foreign policy could somehow be restored to business as usual after Trump would leave office, whether in January of 2021 or 2025. So by investigating the long-term domestic and international trends that predated Trump and will also outlast him, our book actually anticipated the foreign policy emergency that the United States now so clearly faces. Because COVID has tragically illustrated our central thesis, which is that an international system that was built for the challenges of the 1940s is simply not suited to seize the opportunities and address the dangers of the 2040s. So a new approach is obviously needed.
All right. And what would you describe as the major forces that have triggered the collapse of, or the impending collapse of, the liberal international order? If it's not Trump and the personality and behavior of the individual, what is it?
Well, Ben, it's a really important question. And in our diagnosis, it's really a confluence of trends that are both reshaping the United States' role in the world and reshaping the order itself. Before digging into those forces, I think it's important to note that international orders have always changed when global power shifts. That is to say, the norms, rules, and institutions that help to govern international politics are fundamentally intertwined with the power relationships of that system itself. And of course, power in this international system has been shifting for some time, and American leaders are going to have to account for these changes if they seek to chart a new course. So what are these changes? What are the shifts? First, when it comes to changes in the United States' role in the world, some of the most significant factors are actually domestic. In particular, we see domestic political dysfunction as holding hostage, in many ways, U.S. foreign policy. And also the question of whether or not the United States can harness its own technological base as being fundamentally determinative of its competitiveness going forward. Political polarization, of course, has many pernicious consequences, but some of them are specific to foreign policy. It undermines decisive decision making. It can result in suboptimal policy. It creates dramatic swings when parties change hands, when foreign policy really calls for consistency. And it encourages political leaders to back irresponsible parties because they will never be punished by their bases. A clear example, of course, is the fact that the Republican Party has shied away from cracking down on Russian election interference, even though both parties know that it's happening, because it is known to have benefited the president. But beyond political polarization, the United States also has a technology problem on its hands. It's underinvested in research and development and basic research at far below its Cold War levels. And its leading technology companies have, as a result, chased market incentives, sometimes at the cost of national interest. And the United States government itself lacks technological knowledge and talent. So from a domestic perspective, this all amounts to a consistent picture, a country that is still mighty by many metrics in terms of GDP or military power, but is performing tragically far below its own capacity. But there are also some major international forces that are underway that have been transforming international order since well before this COVID crisis. American primacy has been waning for some years as east to west power shifts and technological change fuel China's rise. And this has all undermined the US-led global order. China, of course, has been experiencing explosive growth for decades, and its economy is already the world's largest by some measure, with military power expanding in parallel. China has largely risen within this order, but it now seeks to revise it in some ways to reflect its own power and preferences. And meanwhile, on the technology front, new developments in technology have made the international order increasingly outmoded because there is so little governance in areas like cyberspace, the internet, or artificial intelligence. Now, these two sets of international trends intersect. As technology becomes a central theater of great power competition, China is now seeking to write global rules that protect its domestic model of authoritarianism and advance its interests. And the United States must grapple with how to mount an effective strategic response. This is all to say that the United States is challenged from within at the same time that the international order itself is challenged from within. And it's far from determined whether or not that order can survive.
All right, so let's talk about the domestic side of that for a moment, because part of me looks at this and says, yes, you're clearly right. We have major domestic challenges. We stab each other in the back, including internationally, which we never used to do. Our policies swing hard. Everything you say is really correct. Another part of me says, well, wait a minute. Why should I assume that is a recurring or permanent state of affairs? It didn't used to be the case. We go through periods where we're more polarized and periods where we're less. Things will look very different if Joe Biden wins a smashing election, takes both houses of Congress, than it will if he scrapes by, the opposition party controls the Senate, and we have a long period of gridlock, or another period of gridlock, and that will look still different than if the president gets reelected and faces a Democratic House and a Republican Senate. And so my question is, are you overstating the permanence of the degree of domestic dysfunction that your thesis relies on?
Well, Ben, I wish that we were overstating this problem, but unfortunately, I don't think that's the case. Because while you're correct that the specific array of political forces that exist in Washington, on Capitol Hill, and the White House does change over time, it is also the case that there is a very clear long-term trend of Americans becoming more polarized along partisan lines. And it's been worsening for decades and increasingly has come to inflect foreign policy as well. And this partisan polarization operates on many different levels simultaneously. So in Congress, for example, we see that Republicans and Democrats have grown farther apart on many policy issues, and centrist legislators have all but disappeared from both chambers. The media environment has become hyperpartisan to the extent that Democrats and Republicans now consume quite different information sources and are often unable to even agree on a basic set of facts. And there's also this phenomenon called effective polarization or negative partisanship, which means that members of both parties have actually come to see their counterparts across the aisle in a negative light and to dislike those people and therefore see compromise as itself being unpalatable. And so, unfortunately, while there are certainly elements of the Trump years that have exacerbated many of these problems, they are long-term in nature, and they're going to be with us for a long time. So what do we do about this? I mean, as Mira said, there are many grievous consequences to partisan polarization, but some of the ones that we're beginning to see really have to do with foreign policy. And one that's probably front of mind for many people right now is foreign election interference, because the cleavages that divide the American public are in effect invitations to foreign powers to intervene in our political processes. And the very same polarization is what prevents us from being able to respond effectively, because whenever a foreign power intervenes to help one party, that party is therefore disincentivized to take action to prevent similar affronts on democracy in the future. So our strategy tries to take this threat quite seriously, this internal threat of polarization. And it does so by trying to insulate American foreign policy to the extent that that's possible. And we're consciously modest about our claims there. But we think that the openness strategy that we articulate in the book can find some measure of bipartisan agreement, because it builds on some longstanding areas of consensus that do still exist between the parties and will be probably more salient if and when Trump leaves office. But it also looks to embed the strategy we propose within non-governmental elements, in particular the private sector, because we've seen the way in which, even as the change in hands in the White House between Obama and Trump has resulted in the abrogation of various international agreements, like, for example, withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord, many state and local governments, but also many private companies, have actually continued to try to achieve Paris-like goals or Paris targets, even in the absence of federal policy leadership on those issues. So a key innovation of the openness strategy is actually to build these types of private sector partnerships that will hopefully insulate the strategy from whatever wild volatility might come in the future.
All right. So you've alluded to the openness strategy. The title of the book is An Open World. What is the openness strategy? And faced with this daunting set of problems, both domestic and international, that you articulate, what exactly are you proposing as a strategic vision?
The bottom line, Ben, is that the openness strategy is a new grand strategy for the United States that aims to allow it to secure its dearest interests, even though it has lost military and economic primacy. Now, I want to pause for a minute on the second part of that, the fact that the United States has lost military and economic primacy. What that means in our view is that the United States is no longer an uncontested superpower that faces pretty much no constraints from great power competitors. The period of the unipolar moment that followed the Cold War has essentially ended because China can challenge the United States in political, military, and economic terms. This does not mean that the United States is not powerful. It still remains historically powerful by many measures, but it is no longer uncontested in its power. And that is a really important premise of our strategy. Now, what is the strategy? The objective of this openness approach is to keep the world open and to promote interactions of the same kind. So what does that mean we're seeking to achieve? We're seeking a world in which states can make free and independent decisions, free from coercion. We're seeking a world in which the global commons, such as airspace and waters, stay accessible. We're seeking a world in which there's international cooperation, beneficial trade, and the free flow of information, and in which there is transparent governance in international institutions, critically, even amongst and between states who might not themselves be democracies. So this probably all sounds pretty good. What do we oppose? What we're opposing is domination by hostile states or blocks of states. That could be regional domination, like China trying to dominate parts of Asia, but it could also be functional domination, China trying to close off entire information spaces by exporting its vision of a closed internet to other states and preventing the free flow of information internationally. We're opposed to foreign interference in political processes, and we're opposed to efforts that close off the global commons, like vital waterways such as the South China Sea. So who does this strategy really aim at? Well, it's clearly motivated by China in some ways. As the only major power competitor with preferences to close off parts of the international system and the means to accomplish that, the greatest risk to international openness is China. If left unchecked, China could dominate parts of Asia. It could dominate new areas of technology, making it impossible for states in its region to make free decisions. Or it could dominate existing norms and institutions. But there are also a number of things that it's important to note that openness doesn't mean and doesn't constrain. By calling for an open world, we're not suggesting that China and others can't have plenty of influence. That is, we actually expect that the United States is going to have to live alongside China and other authoritarian states that have preferences for a more closed international system, and it's going to have to live alongside them for a long time. So we're aiming at openness precisely so that we can achieve our security and economic goals, even though we're living alongside these authoritarian competitors. Openness also does not encompass all of America's interests. That is to say, it's a necessary precondition for us to achieve our goals in the world, to allow us to stay interdependent, and to allow us to achieve cooperation in the world, but it doesn't fulfill all of our global aims. And finally, openness doesn't exist without limits. That is to say that in an open world, states will still be able to regulate their borders and to accept some forms of closure, such as regulating their technology industries where their dearest interests demand. So openness is not, like any strategy, a full panacea, but it does express what we believe to be our dearest interests in the world and give us a way forward on how we'll achieve them.
And how is the openness strategy, as you describe it, different from current bipartisan consensus policy? You know, we sail ships through the South China Sea in FONOPS operation now, you know, under the, we don't use the word openness, but it's a freedom of navigation, right? We generally resist balkanization of the internet to the extent that we can. We have, at least until the current administration, generally supported liberalization of trade rules. How is the openness strategy a prescription rather than a description of U.S. policy?
So the United States has a long history of thinking about the general concept of openness as contributing to its security and prosperity. But what our strategy does is make openness the centerpiece of a vision for 21st century order that departs in some really meaningful ways from the status quo. And I'll talk about that more in a second. So at the end of World War II, as FDR was trying to imagine what would come next for the international system, he actually had in mind this idea of openness, the idea that perhaps the Soviet Union would have greater influence in parts of Eastern Europe, but that the United States would nevertheless retain access to that part of the world. But when the Iron Curtain fell, that vision of openness basically came down with it. And by ultimately implicitly acknowledging a closed-off Soviet sphere in Eastern Europe, openness was only really attained in Western Europe and in the sphere of influence that the United States enjoyed. Now, it was with the end of the Cold War that the United States actually had an opportunity to finally reopen parts of the world that had been hived off during the bipolar standoff. But instead of just embracing this idea of openness, the United States actually went well beyond it. It, in the absence of any real bounds on its power and its interests, embraced an idea of liberal universalism, where the idea that American-style liberalism would really spread inexorably and that the whole world would be effectively penetrable by American power. But the problem is that that led to some notable excesses. And also, it has now become impossible given the massive domestic and international changes that we have described. So a couple things to note in terms of the future. Now, first, you said, why isn't this the status quo? Well, I think it's pretty clear that Donald Trump and his administration's policies are at odds with many of the core tenets of an openness strategy. He has pursued unilateralism. He's expressed an utter disinterest in international order and has withdrawn from key institutions. He has abetted foreign election interference and even invited it within the United States. And the Trump administration continues to threaten armed regime change against countries overseas, ranging from Iran to China, itself. So while there might be narrow areas of overlap, for example, in the desire to keep the global commons open, as a general matter, the Trump administration is pursuing a set of policies that are quite dramatically different than the ones that we propose. And you mentioned, for example, the idea of internet governance. Well, actually, the recent moves against TikTok and to try to force a sale of TikTok look much more like taking a page out of Beijing's cyber sovereignty internet governance playbook than they do look like standing up for the free and open vision of the internet that the United States has traditionally espoused. So in the past, the United States has never actually pursued an openness strategy along the lines of the ones that we propose. But we think that this is the way forward. And we also think that there are reasons to believe that openness can succeed in the 21st century, even in places where it failed in the 20th century. So diverging from the sort of FDR-like vision and the way that it foundered in the Cold War, our vision of openness does not assume benign intentions on the part of great power adversaries. It doesn't assume, for example, that China, if it did come to control part of Asia, would openly offer the United States commercial or military transit. In fact, quite the opposite. It recognizes that the several decades of globalization that we have experienced have actually decreased the value of territorial conquest while also increasing the cost of attempts at closure, because any attempts to close off a nation from foreign markets and foreign access actually prevents that nation from benefiting from network effects, from economies of scale, and from specialization. And also it recognizes that the coalescence of norms that militate against the use of military force make geography in many ways less relevant. They make military force less potent, and they make information and commerce more important, which is all to say that closure should be more difficult to achieve in the 21st century and also less advantageous to the states that seek to pursue it, which means that an openness strategy can finally meet its moment in 2020.
All right. So if I'm Xi Jinping and I'm listening to this conversation, my reaction to it is, that's very nice. And I understand that the United States wants the world to be open, by which the United States means to use its standards, not ours. But we have a lot of market muscle. We have military muscle. We're the manufacturer of the world. And we're not going to play this game. The South China Sea is indisputably ours. And so say the word open all you want, and we will say the words, you know, secure and controllable about the internet, secure and safe, or whatever the rhetoric is. And we'll play this semantic game all you want. At the end of the day, we're going to do business on our terms, not yours. So I guess my question is, in what sense is openness a strategy versus a slogan? And how do you deploy the strategy against very powerful actors that don't want it?
It's a great question, Ben. And frankly, it's a question that besets a lot of strategies, right? How do you actually bring something that is coined to be a focal bumper sticker objective into reality? We think that openness is both a strategy and that, frankly, is at least somewhat advantageous for China compared to the alternative, because it does accept that the United States is going to be living in the world alongside a stronger China. And importantly, that the United States and its allies do not have the ability to change the character of the Chinese regime. Now, that second thing that I just said is not an uncontroversial point. There are many smart people, strategists, policymakers, et cetera, who would very much like to transform the character of the Chinese Communist Party. And part of what we're acknowledging here is that the premise of liberal universalism that has so long guided the liberal international order, at least since the end of the Cold War period, is not going to come to fruition, at least not right now. That is to say that countries like Russia and China are going to get to continue to choose the character of their regime for the foreseeable future and until their people choose otherwise. And we think it's important to acknowledge this, even though it's a really unsavory principle, because it allows us to make more pragmatic strategy and policy. That is to figure out how we're going to live alongside a world with these stronger authoritarian powers. So that brings us to your question, sort of why should China care? What's ultimately in it for China? And how does this translate to action on the global stage? We think importantly that framing our international objectives in terms of openness is an advantageous strategy move for the United States because it allows it to partner with all manner of states who are willing to conduct international affairs according to this principle. That is to say, rather than simply framing a strategy in terms of a standoff between democracy and authoritarianism, we're saying that we are willing to build new institutions, craft new regimes, and partner with states who are willing to operate by open governance principles on the international stage, even if they're not full-fledged democracies. That means that on tech, we want to work with states who might be wary of working with China and accepting the security risks of China's 5G systems, but who may not themselves be fully signed up to democratic principles. On keeping the South China Sea open, we're willing to work with countries like Vietnam or Malaysia, who are not perfect democratic regimes, but who nonetheless share our interests in keeping the global commons open. And ultimately, if China is willing to bring some of its own initiatives, like the Belt and Road Initiative, into better compliance with these open principles, we're willing to work with them in those areas too. So this is all to say that rather than framing our objectives on the global stage in ideological terms, we believe that openness is ultimately a winning strategy for the United States because it maximizes the number of opportunities to work with partners of different types of regimes. It maximizes, or rather accepts, the fact that we're going to have to pursue different strategies towards different forms of order. That is to say, grouping with different coalitions on freedom of navigation than we do on technology or human rights issues. And it ultimately acknowledges that this process of order building alongside authoritarians, many of whom may reject our preferences, is going to be a long, hard slog. But that doesn't necessarily necessitate some form of conflict with the Chinas and Russias of the world. Rather, implies that we're going to be in this competition for an open order that will guide us for some years to come.
All right. So the flip side of the same question is, Xi Jinping listens to this conversation and he says, when we've talked about opening markets in the past, that has in fact meant they open their markets to us much more than we open our markets to them. Openness has actually been good for China in the sense that we open less than things open to us. So maybe the answer is you play along with this strategy, but you do it in a way that turns it a little bit on its head. And so my question is, how vulnerable is it to that? Openness is the kind of thing that open societies like ours like to say, but are we potentially making ourselves very vulnerable by making ourselves more open than the interlocutors can be expected reasonably to make themselves?
Well, this strategy is actually an attempt to prevent the exploitation of open societies like the United States by malign foreign actors. And whether that means unfair trade practices by China or foreign election interference by Russia, we are clear-eyed about those threats and those vulnerabilities that are embedded within an idea of openness that is nevertheless desirable and beneficial for the United States. So first things first, let's be clear that when we're talking about openness, we don't mean unfettered domestic openness. This is a vision for international openness. And the reason that that distinction matters is because To achieve the open world that we're describing, the United States does not have to throw open its borders to unrestricted immigration. It doesn't have to throw open its markets to unrestricted flow of goods and capital from foreign sources. And it also doesn't have to accept the sort of unfettered neoliberalism that has dominated much of the post-Cold War period. Instead, an open world at its core is about the interactions between states and trying to make those interactions as open and transparent as possible. Now, part of that is the pursuit of beneficial economic interdependence, because trade ultimately, when it's done in a high standards way that is fair, benefits the United States. The preponderance of markets for American goods are overseas, and the United States has a central role in the international financial system that confers many benefits upon it and is actually a great source of leverage in an interdependent world. So we don't want to retreat from that interdependence, but we do want to modernize the terms on which it is happening in ways that are more advantageous to the United States. So take the example that you brought up of China and the international trading system. Well, China has all but broken the WTO by continuing to pursue unfair market practices that aren't actually covered by WTO guidelines and regulations. For example, its large state-owned enterprises. So what an openness strategy tries to do is bring China better in line with openness by closing off the vectors by which it has sought to exploit the system in the past. So that means, in the first instance, trying to update the WTO to reflect the way that international commerce currently occurs. That means creating guidelines around SOEs and the way in which countries are able to use them and other forms of subsidies. But it also means expanding the WTO to cover massive forms of global commerce that it simply does not speak to right now, like digital trade and services, something that in the times of coronavirus quarantines are becoming ever more vital to everybody's lives and businesses. So WTO reform would be great, but the WTO is a consensus-based organization, and it may be that China is simply unwilling to sign on to any of the reforms that the Washington might seek in order to mitigate unfair market practices and protect American businesses and workers. So in that event, the United States has other options. As still the largest economy in the world, the United States has a lot of market power and can rally other states behind it to create new forms of high-standard multilateral trade agreements that basically write new rules where they don't exist right now. And China will not sign on to those agreements, at least not in the foreseeable future. But those agreements will change the incentives that China faces in operating internationally and may, in the long haul, prove to be an outside-in way to renovate the international trading system as it exists right now. Now, there are also going to be places where the United States wants to, in a very narrow and targeted way, accept certain forms of closure to protect highly sensitive domestic industries or technologies from external exploitation as a result of our own openness. But every time it embraces that kind of caveat, the United States ought to do so with great caution, because as a leader of an open international system, the United States has to lead by example. And so while some narrow caveats are required and might be desirable, it doesn't want to set a precedent that states will opt out of the norms, rules, and institutions of openness for all kinds of reasons. And in many ways, the way that the Trump administration has invoked national security as a justification for not playing by the rules of the international trading system is an example of exactly the type of behavior that an openness strategy would seek to avoid.
How central to an openness strategy are allies? Because it seems to me that at the end of the day, one entity, even a very large, powerful entity, arguing for a kind of transactional openness in the international space, it really only works if it can persuade large numbers of other countries to engage on that basis. I guess the more confrontational way to ask this question would be to say, is this a kind of philosophically and theoretically elaborate way of saying revitalize our alliances and have those alliances stand for certain values that traditionally the United States has represented in the international arena?
Well, there's no question, Ben, that allies are absolutely critical. With the United States past its power peak, keeping the world open is a significant charge. And frankly, it is only feasible if the United States is working closely with its treaty allies and fully has them on board. But I would note that this isn't just sort of philosophical top cover for saying that we need to work more with our allies, because the task is actually bigger than just allies. It does involve, as Rebecca has been speaking to, a broader strategy for international order, to which allies are central, but for which they are not sufficient to bring it about. So first, on the question of allies, generally, militarily and with respect to many other forms of challenges, you know, Russia's subconventional advances, China's actions in the South China Sea or in cyberspace, American allies share the goal of keeping Asia open and Europe politically independent from Russia. And there are some exceptions to that, of course. The United States has on its ledger a few democratically backsliding allies who we might not necessarily associate with an open strategy, but by and large, our allies are at least aligned with this concept in principle. And their choices going forward will help to determine the success or failure of an openness strategy. Ultimately, they'll have to decide whether they're joining with the United States to back institutional reforms necessary to save leading organizations like the World Trade Organization, whether they'll join with us to set new rules and norms to govern the internet and cyberspace to keep them open, and whether alongside us, they'll upgrade their own defense strategies to protect and defend the global commons. And of course, we could sort of elaborate on these points and think about the types of 5G decisions that our allies in Europe and Asia have faced just in the last few years, which we think, frankly, would have been conversations that would have proceeded much more productively if openness had been a guiding principle, as opposed to sort of the false binary choice presented to allies of with us or against us, are you going with China's technology or not? But definitionally, as you're pointing to, the United States fundamentally cannot keep the world open on its own. These shared alliance goals will have to translate into common strategy if we are to prevail. But as my remarks, I hope, have highlighted, the simple fact of revitalizing our alliances is not going to be enough. Simply by building back the structures of NATO or our bilateral system of pacts in Asia, we're not going to be able to keep the world open on our own. We're going to have to turn all of our alliances towards this general charge of renovating existing sclerotic institutions and building new ones if we are to keep these regional and functional spaces open.
So one of those new institutions that we were about to create when the president came into office was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which in some ways seems like a case study in the kind of openness strategy that you're describing. That is, it had significant trade elements, it had significant incorporation of non-democratic countries. It was pretty broad-based, and it is no longer extant. So my last question is this the kind of thing that an openness strategy would seek? And if not, what was the openness deficiency about it that would differentiate it from the kind of thing that you guys are thinking about?
So without speaking to the very specific critiques that many have leveled against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, at a broad level, as we discussed a moment ago, multilateral and plurilateral trade agreements are an essential part of this strategy. Because in a world in which the WTO is beleaguered by the lack of consensus and the ways in which market distorting activities have been allowed to continue because they skirt WTO rules, even if they don't directly contravene them, that body is not fit for purpose to meet 21st century economic challenges. So we need to build a system that is. And if the WTO can't reform, then the United States needs to lead in trying to amass a correlation of forces that favors openness in the international economic arena. And high standards international trade agreements that have good labor protections, that advance our climate goals, that cover new areas of a 21st century economy, that has to be part of the equation. And there does need to be an affirmative trade agenda that is being pursued for an openness strategy to succeed. Now, to say that is not to ignore the fact that trade agreements have adverse distributional consequences, including at home. So an openness strategy looks that problem in the face. It makes the judgment that, in general, trade agreements advance the American economy by allowing us to do better trade and therefore grow as a nation. But they also have winners and losers. And if we're going to continue to pursue trade agreements that are anything like the TPP, then we need to take domestic measures to address the way that they impact American workers and American businesses. Because the combination of trade agreements and trade liberalization and automation and other technological changes have been really devastating for many American workers. But at the end of the day, addressing many of those domestic issues is not really the central task of foreign policy. And so, yes, labor needs to have a seat at the table in future trade agreements. Yes, trade agreements need to be entered into with the American middle class fundamentally in mind and represented, and in fact, front of mind. But the design of trade agreements is not going to be able to solve all of the problems that are created by participating in an economically interdependent global trading system. So there has to be a domestic policy counterpart to the openness strategy that, especially in the wake of the COVID pandemic, ensures that all Americans have good job opportunities, can achieve prosperity and security for themselves and their families in a modern international economy and in a modern domestic economy.
We are going to leave it there. The book is An Open World: How America Can Win the Contest for 21st Century Order. The authors are Rebecca Lissner and Mira Rapp Hooper. Rebecca and Mira, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, our audio engineer. This episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. It is underwritten by you when you go to thelawfarestore.com and buy all our merch, and when you go to the Support Lawfare page and, you know, support Lawfare. It's also powered by you when you tweet about us, share us on Facebook, and upvote us on Reddit. It is your public relations firm that promotes us every time you rate us or review us on whatever podcast distribution service you found us. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.